Hello, welcome to Food, Nutrition, Culture, and Diabetes, a podcast series that explores culinary traditions, health beliefs, and practices with an emphasis on culturally competent diabetes counseling. Today's spotlight is on India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Hello, my name is Lorena Drago. I'm a registered dietitian and a certified diabetes educator and the owner of Hispanic Foodways. You can visit HispanicFoodWays.com for nutrition and diabetes information in English and Spanish. Well, let's talk about a little bit about diabetes. And the American Diabetes Association estimates that about 8% of the population, that's roughly 24 million people, have diabetes. And the number is steadily increasing, especially when it comes to minorities. And diabetes is a disease that not only has an impact on an individual and a community level, but also it impacts the economical, political, and even social system. So here today to talk about Asian Indian culture, including food, nutrition, and also to provide healthcare professionals with counseling tips is our invited and esteemed guest, Carmine Kulkarni. Welcome, Carmine.
Thank you, Lorena. I appreciate the opportunity to be on this podcast and look forward to our time in discussing this topic.
Thank you, Carmine. As I was saying, Carmine is a wonderful guest, and I am really looking forward to our exchange. But let me tell you a little bit about Carmine. She is an advanced practice registered dietitian and a certified diabetes educator. Carmine has a master's in food and nutrition, and she's currently the Director of Scientific Affairs at Abbott Diabetes Care in Vivo Marketing. She was also the coordinator for the Diabetes Center at St. Mark's Hospital in Salt Lake City until September of 2006. I have to say that she has held numerous local, state, and national leadership positions, including the 2002 recipient of the American Diabetes Association Outstanding Educator in Diabetes Award. So it is quite a treat to have Carmine with us today. So let's talk a little bit about cultural food practices in the Asian Indian population. And Carmine, let's start with letting our listeners know a little bit about where in the United States do we find the largest concentration of Indian, Pakistanians, and Bangladeshis?
I would say that we'd look at both East and West Coast. So you'd be looking at New York City, Boston, Chicago as we move towards the Midwest. And we also have a large percentage of the population in California, Northern and Southern California, cities like Los Angeles, San Francisco, Texas, Houston, and Dallas. Both of those cities have large populations from the Indian subcontinent, as we call it, which includes India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
And I would like you to clarify a little bit about that. I live in New York City, and in New York City, there is an area in Jackson Heights, Queens, and there is a very large population. Now, for someone like me, that would not know the differences between someone that comes from India or from Pakistan or from Bangladesh. Can you enlighten us a little bit?
Pakistan and Bangladesh, their commonality is that the populations are largely Muslim in terms of religion, which definitely impacts food practices and culture and religious belief when it comes to food, which is related to their fasting at religious holidays, etc. In terms of their ethnic backgrounds, there is some difference because what is currently known as Pakistan used to be West Pakistan, and Bangladesh was East Pakistan. It was all one country, but divided by geographically by India. So the current country of Pakistan people are ethnic origins are from the Punjab or Sindh provinces of that region. So the food habits are quite different. Food choices are different. People from Bangladesh, even though they are also Muslim and follow Islam, and that impacts food practices and choices, tend to have more Bengali types of food choices in terms of more rice and fish and those types of things. So there are some ethnic differences in terms of food choices and what was available many years ago and which evolved in terms of what our current day food practices.
That's great. Now, if someone like me, I have a patient that comes in, what would be the most tactful or culturally competent way for me to know where that person comes from? Is it appropriate for me to ask what is your country of origin or your place of origin to even be more detailed?
Yeah, I think it would be very appropriate, Lorena, to ask them, you know, which country are you originally from? And the purpose of that interest would be, you know, to help me understand your traditional food practices so I could help you with your food choices and diabetes management if that was the purpose of the visit.
Okay. I think that's wonderful, and I want to emphasize that because many times, even when we're looking at studies, when we're looking at statistics, many different countries are put together into one group. And that happens with Hispanics, Latinos, even though there are so many different countries and so many regions within the country that are different. And many times it would be helpful for the healthcare professional to ask, but many times we might refrain from asking because we do not want to touch any landmines in the cultural aspect that offends someone. So I think the point that you made about letting someone know the reason that I'm asking is because I want to make sure that I address your specific cultural issues. I think it's very important. Now, I'm always fascinated, and I'm moving into food and diabetes. Many times, different cultures view diabetes differently, and that makes it a challenge for educators to help someone achieve his or her goals because they might see diabetes as something that it's inevitable or something that they have no control of. So in general, and I know this is a very broad statement, how do Indians, Pakistani, Bangladeshi view diabetes?
Diabetes has become more of an issue in all three countries, Lorena, and there has been a lot of press and information disseminated regarding the incidence of it, the fact that it is a national epidemic in these three countries, the numbers are growing, that it is serious and they need and that people need to take care of it. So there's a lot more visibility to diabetes in these three countries in the recent few years than there used to be. So as we compare it to a few years ago, people knew about diabetes, knew it was a disease. They didn't think that type 2 diabetes was very serious, kind of a parallel to what we had in the United States a few years ago, and that the seriousness of the type 2 diabetes was accelerated when the person started insulin. But now I see, I just recently returned from a trip to India, and I see that there is a lot more public awareness about it, and people are perceiving it to be serious and a health issue and chronic and that they need to take care of it.
Okay, so I'm glad that they are at least attempting to take care of their diabetes. Now, moving into food, And I have always been fascinated with the culture and the food traditions. Again, living in Jackson Heights since I arrived here to this country and having access to many different foods and different textures and different kinds of seasonings, I was just fascinated with the variety, especially the regional varieties of foods. So in every culture, we have foods that are considered healthy, or good for diabetes, or bad for diabetes. And that's so important for health educators to know. If you can pick just a handful of foods that are considered to be healthy and probably incorporated into their meal plans, what would they be, and also the foods that most individuals might stay away from?
Great question, Lorena. And typically, these populations from these three countries perceive that rice and potatoes and fruit are dangerous or detrimental to blood glucose excursions. And yet they are part, such an integral part of the cuisine, that it is imperative for the diabetes educator working with these populations to understand that they can convey the fact that people with diabetes of these three countries could include rice, potatoes, and fruit in the appropriate amounts at different meals in combinations with other foods and enjoy them and not totally eliminate them from their entire lifestyle.
So and these are the foods that are quote-unquote forbidden, so to speak,
exactly,
for most people once they have diabetes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, exactly. And so for, as you and I know, we are emotionally attached to our ethnic foods and we want them. And so that's part of living day-to-day with diabetes, is to incorporate these foods. In terms of what are appropriate, what are considered appropriate foods are lentils, legumes, which are known as dals typically, and they could be very liquid, medium thick consistency to a very thick consistency. All types of vegetables, particularly the non-starchy vegetables, and a lot of spices, condiments, yogurt are all considered in the healthy domain.
And something that I have been fascinated when I have talked to diabetes educators from different ethnic groups, religious groups, and that is that when a group of individuals consider a food to be healthy, then portions go out the window. So if I think that yogurt is healthy, then I can eat as much as I want. Does that say that rule applies to the population, Indian population as well?
Yes, it does. And as you know, with most ethnic populations, food is a social bond between people, and hospitality is a big part of the entire culture. So when guests arrive or they're visiting other family or friends, food is always served, and hospitality is demonstrated by encouraging the guests to eat a second and a third and a fourth time. And the guest feels pressured that if they don't eat, they're not showing appreciation for the host, so that that's a whole different social dynamics that needs to be discussed in the counseling session by the diabetes educator in relation to what you just mentioned about portion sizes.
Great. Let me talk a little bit about acculturation and assimilation to the quote-unquote, and I'm going to use the term loosely, the American diet. What are the most prevalent, both on the positive and the negative aspects, that you have seen dietary changes as a result of acculturation?
Well, there has been some very interesting transition. There have been some surveys done of food consumption practices, in this population living in the U.S. For at least 5 years or so. And what happens is that a lot of the food items like meals and the complete meals are replaced in terms of like the traditional sweets are replaced by cookies, donuts, other Western pastries. Now, in these countries, typically butter and clarified butter, known as ghee, spelled G-H-E-E, are used very, very extensively. And when, as part of the acclimatization to the American culture, margarine use increases and it's used as an alternative. Most of the people continue to consume the rice or the flat wheat bread known as chapati, or yogurt and dal and curried vegetables. But they also tend to have an increased intake of whole grain bread, meat, fish, poultry, margarine, potato chips, cakes, cheese, fruits, alcoholic and non-alcoholic beverages. So there's definitely a tendency there. But that being said, we're seeing a lot of westernization in these three countries too. So there is sort of a parallel transition happening in their homelands too.
That's a very interesting point, and I really want to touch on that, because I believe that as we have a global society, it is very common, and this happens to me when I travel overseas, that I am finding but less difference between one country and the United States, because many of the chains, the food chains that we see here, I can find in Mexico City, I can find in Panama City, I can find in Colombia, and in other countries of Latin America. So we are seeing this new group of individuals that are adapting to this globalization of food to a certain degree, especially in the large cities. So it's very interesting. So when individuals migrate to the United States, there might not be that marked difference, especially if they are adapting to this globalization of food intake.
I agree with you. I think that we are definitely in a global society, and some of the differences are definitely being bridged, and there's more commonality than not anymore.
Yes, I find that very, very interesting as well when I travel. Now, if one colleague, another registered dietitian, had asked me one time, Amanda Archibald, and she had asked me that in one of her nutrition workshops, field to plate, she had one person, she would ask the individuals, if you have to counsel someone from a certain cultural group or ethnic or religious group, and you have to go shopping with them and counsel them, would you know what they shopped? Would you know what foods they would purchase? And unfortunately, many dietitians did not know. So I would like to know, if I visited a traditional Indian home, and you can specify whether it's from the south, from the north, what would be a handful of staple foods that I would most likely find in every kitchen? And I know that I'm generalizing, but just to give us an idea of what the major traditional food items might be.
Certainly, and I think we can safely generalize up to a point, because there's some basic staples that most homes would have, which would be a variety of lentils and legumes, and that will vary from region to region depending on which ones they've stocked up on most. There's always going to be rice. There's always going to be wheat flour. There's always going to be a variety of spices and seasonings. Always regional ethnic pickles, vegetables, and a lot of areas use onion, onions, ginger, and garlic for cooking, but there are certain ethnic groups, that subsets, who do not eat onion and garlic, so they may not have that. So that kind of gives you sort of a basic staple stocking of the shelves.
Now, Carmine, you mentioned wheat flour, and I was copying them down. Wheat flour, what would the wheat flour be used for? What dishes?
The wheat flour really is going to be the used for the traditional types of breads that are made. The chapati, which is a flat bread, which looks very similar to a tortilla, and or puris, which are also smaller, but they're deep fat fried. Then you've got the naan, which is a thicker, larger flat bread that is served. You can find them in Indian restaurants or even in Indian stores, and it's served usually with the tandoori type of chicken or meat or fish. There are parathas, which are, again, made from the wheat flour, which are thicker and larger, and sometimes the vegetables are added to it, like potatoes or different green vegetables. So there are a variety of actually the bread products that would be the bread counterpart to a U.S. Dining table of foods, where a loaf of bread or bread rolls or muffins would be served. These would be the counterpart.
Now, you mentioned puri, which is a fried product made out of wheat. When would puri be utilized?
Well, actually, puri would be utilized, you know, it could be a breakfast food, depending what the accompaniment is. It could be used for lunch or dinner or snack, depending on what is served with it, because it could be served with a spiced potato mixture of with some ingredients, or it could be served with different dals. It could be served with different vegetables, so depending on what's on the menu.
So some kind of wheat product would be common to have at every meal, regardless of whether
wheat,
it's the
chapati. That would be, and wheat is more common in the northern part of India than in the southern part of India, whereas rice is more common in the southern part.
Okay. Now, if I only have, and this is what I call the survival skills, if I only have a limited amount of time and I had to focus on three food and nutrition tips, and I didn't know much about it, but I really wanted to hone in on something that perhaps I might not otherwise know, what would those tips be?
Basically, the tips would be that we would look at the population, reducing the amount of fat and fried items, and they can still have their own ethnic foods and broil and use minimal amount of oils and trim all the fat in terms of still even using ghee or butter or oil. So that would be a main piece right there.
And I want to interrupt you because I want to know, what would be an acceptable substitution for ghee? What kind of other fats would be acceptable?
Well, the you know, there's a lot of emotional attachment to ghee because it's used in religious ceremonies and different things.
Oh.
And a lot of families have started using canola oil, and it's very acceptable. And just reducing the amount of overall oil. Some like the flavor of ghee, so one option is to reduce the amount of ghee if it's a large quantity of food, and then by the time you portion it out, you're getting very little amount, and that would be an opportunity to have the flavor and yet cut down the quantity, like you had talked about portions. Another tip would be bringing attention to the fact that potatoes and peas are starchy foods, even though they're considered vegetables, and substituting in most recipes, reducing the amount of potato and peas and adding more of the non-starchy vegetables. And there's just a huge amount of non-starchy vegetables in the cuisine of these three countries that is very, very wonderful. A third would be the increased intake of dals and lentils because, as we know, several years ago, we had some research in the area of carbohydrates which showed the dals and lentils having a very flat rise in postprandial glucose. And they had actually called those category of foods as lente carbohydrates, using the term for lente or slow-acting old-fashioned insulin that some of us did know. So those would be the three that could come to the top and maybe reduce the amount of rice in terms of quantity because a lot of people use rice as a filler, and that doesn't really help because, again, it goes back to the portion sizes.
Now, we have not talked or you have not mentioned anything in terms of animal byproducts or what we call the meat substitutes. And I know that a certain part of the population is vegetarian, but for the other part that it's not vegetarian that consumes animal byproducts, whether it's chicken or beef, what would be those products that might be widely consumed, and how are they prepared?
Well, in the north, primarily is where the non-vegetarian animal products would be utilized, as we call them, and so there would be a large use of chicken and goat's meat and fish on the coastal areas. So usually that's prepared in a fairly healthy fashion. There's always the tandoor, which is more of a barbecue and not a lot of fat. Fish also is made in curries, and once they reduce the amount of fat in that or oil, that should work. But a lot of the chicken and the fish and stuff is also fried. So, again, that counseling point over there. Goat's meat is not widely utilized or available in the United States. So when you're looking at counseling here, there's a lot of use of lamb. And based on the ethnic and religious background, Muslims may eat beef but not pork, whereas Hindus will not eat beef or pork and would probably eat chicken and fish. So finding that information out is also very helpful for individuals.
Oh, I think that that's an excellent point because I wouldn't have made all that connection that depending on the region, depending on the religious practices, some meats or meat equivalents might or might not be consumed. So I think that that's a very helpful tip. Now, many times as dietitians or healthcare professionals that assist with nutrition counseling and providing information, there are so many different meal plans, and a lot of people like to use them, just give them a meal plan along with counseling. But many of the meal plans or the food lists that are available do not have many of the traditional foods. So the person from a certain part of the world might feel, well, this is great, but what happens with some of the foods that I like to eat? And I know that you had mentioned about the dal and the rice and the potatoes. What are the things that come to your mind that if I were to have that meal plan and I went to use it as a tool, I would have to add those foods? I know that for Hispanics, I usually add, especially if they're from the Caribbean, from Puerto Rico, or the Dominican Republic and Cuba, I usually add starchy root vegetables like the plantains and the cassavas and the yams. So what would be foods that someone like me would not know, but I would need to add to those meal plans?
I would definitely add the chapati, the naan, the puris. Be aware of spices and seasonings that will be used. the onions and the oil and the cooking. And also other things would be the Indian desserts, which are usually milk or yogurt based and are extremely sweet with large amounts of fat and sugar.
And they are absolutely delicious, I have to say.
They're great. Jackson, I love
Hyde
them too.
Queens, absolutely delicious. that's just my take when I have purchased them. Other foods, Carmine, that you might think of that non-Asian Indians or Pakistani or Bangladeshi educators might not be aware of, especially those that contain carbohydrate, that are our flag should be raised because we might not include them?
Well, basically, I think your basic staple carbohydrate foods in these populations are usually the rice, the dals, the potatoes, the peas, fruit. And the issue there is typically the quantity because, I mean, if you look at 15 grams of carb as one serving, being one-third cup of rice cooked, for most of these individuals of these backgrounds, for them that's one bite.
Okay.
And, you know, and for them, like, 2 cups of cooked rice is a definitely substantial meal. But what that would do to a postprandial blood glucose would be quite dramatic.
Great. Now, just to finalize, I just want to cover something that I believe is very important for health educators. What remedies, non-prescriptions, are commonly used to treat diabetes, or they're famous, or at least by word of mouth, anecdotally, or maybe not, that we should be aware of?
Yeah, there are some, of course, herbal and powder-type remedies from the homeopathic practitioners or people who practice Ayurveda, which is several thousands of years old. And in some individuals, anecdotally, with no evidence-based medicine, they've at the first few years of diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, it does seem to help with blood glucose levels. With regards to certain vegetables, bitter gourd, one known as karela, K-R-E-L-A, is eaten with the belief that it would reduce blood glucose and has a dampening effect on the glycemic rise. Recently, cinnamon has come to the top, and so people are using that. So there's different, you know, there's definitely a lot of interest in those types of things.
What resources, in terms of recipes, what the different foods are, and other food and cultural culinary traditions do we have access to that we can add that to our arsenal of tools?
Definitely. There is a book on the website for the American Association of Physicians from India, and this was put together in a voluntary fashion by dietitians of Indian origin and Pakistani origin living in the United States. It's called Indian Foods, Aapi's Guide to Nutrition, Health, and Diabetes.
And where can someone...
They would have to go to the website for that particular organization.
Great. And I also want to say, to conclude, that Carmine Kulkarni is the author of a chapter of the American Dietetic Association Cultural Food Practices, and it will be launched at the end of 2009. So we are really looking forward to counseling tips and words of wisdom. I want to thank you, Carmine, for being our guest today and sharing cultural food practices of India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lorena, for the opportunity and for being such an excellent interviewer. I appreciate it.
Thank you.